Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah, halfway through the chapter, 48, verses 26 to the end of the chapter, verse 47. I will entitle this audio, Judgment on Moab, Part B. In our last audio, we took up this chapter and basically went over a lot of geography in Moab, and Jeremiah is basically saying, Moab, you're toast. The Babylonians are going to get you. Now, there's no question about when this happened. This was in roughly 582 BC, as the Encyclopedia Britannica has it. They're probably taking 587 as the date of the downfall of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Josephus says it was 5 years after that, which gives us 582. Of course, many people take the judgment on Babylon to be 586, so maybe that would make it 581, but around that period, about 5 years after the Babylonians had wiped out Jerusalem, they're going to wipe out Moab. And so we pick up the story here in chapter 48, verses 26 through 28. Make her drink, for she has defied the Lord. Let Moab wallow in her vomit. Let her be an object of ridicule. Now, who's speaking here? Is it Jeremiah or Yahweh? It's really hard to say in this chapter. The quotation marks are not in the original text. And the NIV has it one way, the Holman Christian Study Bible has it another way. The NIV continues the quotation marks from previous verses, which have Yahweh speaking. So let's just take it as God telling the Moabites, make her drunk, for she has defied the Lord. Let Moab wallow in her vomit. That's what drunken men do. As John Gill puts it, he wants to translate it differently. He says, he shall clap or dash his hand in his vomit, instead of wallow in his vomit. Okay, either way, it's very descriptive. Dash his hands and feet against the ground as he lies in his vomit, as persons in such a condition too. Or shall wring his hands and clap them together for sorrow, being sick and in distress. So Moab is about to get punished. Let her be an object of ridicule. Drunken men invite derision. People ridicule them. And likewise, Moab is going to be like a drunken man, ridiculed amongst the nations. Verse 27, was not Israel the object of your ridicule? Well, yes, Israel has been the object of Moab's ridicule for a long time. Let me read you the scriptures that tell us that. We start in Zephaniah 2:8. Zephaniah prophesied during the times of Josiah, 640 to 609, so therefore he was an early contemporary of Jeremiah. Zephaniah says this, I have heard the taunting of Moab and the insults of the Ammonites, who have taunted my people and threatened their territory. Well, taunting sounds like ridicule. Numbers 22, 4 through 5. Let's go back into history. This is the time of the Exodus. So the Moabites said to the elders of Midian, those were the leaders of a nomadic tribe that's in the area of Moab. The Moabites said to the elders of that tribe, Midian, this horde, the Jews, will devour everything around us like an ox eats up the green plants in the field. Since Balak, son of Zippor, was Moab's king at that time, he sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor, that's up in Syria, which is by the Euphrates in the land of his people. Balak said to him, look, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the surface of the land and are living right across from me. And the story goes on where Balak hires Balaam to curse Israel. Balaam won't do it because God restrains him. But the Moabites there at a critical time in Israel's exodus tries to curse them, which means back then in ancient Near East, I mean, a curse meant we want you dead. Now let's go beyond the times of the Exodus and go to the time of the Judges around, say, 1200 BC or so. Judges 3, verses 12 through 14. The Israelites again did what was evil in the Lord's sight. He gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel because they had done what was evil in the Lord's sight. After Eglon convinced the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join forces with him, he attacked and defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms. That's in Gedi, halfway down the western coast of the Dead Sea. The Israelites served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. So the Israelites were actually subjugated to Moab for 18 years during the time of the Judges. 2 Kings 3, verses 4 through 7. This is a little bit later. This incident took place in the 9th century B.C. We read about it in 2 Kings 3, verses 4 through 7. King Mesha of Moab was a sheep breeder. He used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But when Ahab, who ruled from 874 to 853 BC, but when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Joram, the new king, there was an intermediate king. There was an intervening king, but he is now king. He ruled from 852 to 841. So King Joram marched out from Samaria at that time and mobilized all Israel. Remember, Ahab and King Joram are kings of northern Israel. Verse 7, then he sent a message to King Jehoshaphat of Judah. Jehoshaphat is king in the south. He ruled from 870 to 848. And so Joram sends a message to Jehoshaphat, and he says, the king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? Jehoshaphat said, I will go. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. This expedition takes up the whole chapter 3 of 2 Kings, which I won't read, but it ended at Kir-Hareseth, that city in the far southwestern corner of Moab, right at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. This expedition ended at Kir-Hareseth when Misha of Moab, the king, sacrificed his son on the wall. Very interesting incident. And Israel took off when that happened. So we see that there's a long, long history of enmity between the Moabites and the Israelites. John Gill says the Moabites rejoiced, which they ought not have done, upon the common principles of humanity, and especially since they were neighbors. Well, I don't think back then nations who were opposed to Israel were too concerned about humanity, and I don't think they were concerned about being neighbors. But Joseph Benson points out there's another reason why Moab was so unjustified in attacking Israel. Israel had never done any harm to Moab. When Moses marched through Moab to get to the Promised Land, he did nothing to harm the people of Moab and only responded to Moab when they tried to seduce all the Israelites and when they tried to curse Israel. Now, Moab is said to have taunted Israel in verse 27 of Jeremiah 48. Was not Israel the object of your ridicule? And of course, I don't know which one of these incidents Jeremiah or Yahweh might have been speaking of. I also speculate that the Moabites taunted Israel when the Babylonians came and wiped out Judah in 586. They might have taunted Judah when the Assyrians came and tried to wipe out Jerusalem in 701 under Sennacherib. I don't know. But at any rate, we know that Moab hated Israel, and now they're going to pay for it. At the end of verse 27 was Moab caught among thieves. In other words, you catch a thief, he should be ashamed. And so Jeremiah is asking, was Israel caught like a thief, Moab, so that you should wag your finger at her and point at her and say, you thief, you worthless piece of garbage? Was Israel caught like a thief that you, Moab, should shake your head in scorn whenever you speak of Israel? Verse 28, abandon your towns and dwell among the rocks, you who live in Moab. Be like a dove that makes its nest at the mouth of a cave. Doves, when they get in trouble, like to fly into caves and make nest in caves so that they cannot be attacked. And so Jeremiah is saying, you better get out of town, because your towns are going to get wiped out by the Babylonians, so you're going to have to live in caves among the rocks. We go to Jeremiah 48, verses 29 through 32. We have heard of Moab's pride, her overweening pride and conceit, her pride and arrogance, and the haughtiness of her heart. Notice that pride has been mentioned in verse 29 three times. Her overweening pride and conceit, her pride and arrogance, and the haughtiness of her heart. I know her insolence, but it is futile, declares the Lord, and her boast accomplish nothing. Therefore I wail over Moab, for all Moab I cry out. I moan for the men of Kir-Hareseth. Kir-Hareseth is the town that I mentioned that Misha, king of Moab, was ruling from in the far southwest of Moab, right down at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. I weep for you as Jazer weeps, O vines of Sibmah. Your branches spread as far as the sea. They reached as far as the sea of Jazer. The destroyer has fallen on your ripened fruit and grapes. Now, in verse 29, we have a pronoun we. We have heard of Moab's pride. Who is that we? Well, it could be Israel and the surrounding nations. It could be the three persons of the Trinity. Sometimes God does refer to himself as we, kind of like a royal we, and some people have said, well, that stands for the Trinity. I never have bought that argument. There's plenty of other verses saying that there's a Trinity. We don't have to rely on that one. It could be Judah and God. God is speaking and saying, we, all of Judah, and I, Yahweh, have heard of Moab's pride. That's my idea. Pulpit commentary, I think, has it best. I think it refers to Jeremiah and his countrymen, as that commentary says. We, all of us people of Judah, have heard of Moab's pride. Now, of course, the quotation marks would have to be different than they are in the NIV. The Holman Christian Study Bible has no quotation marks, which makes the passage spoken by Jeremiah, if you examine it. Again, that's so confusing, doesn't really matter. Could be that Yahweh is just quoting Isaiah, because, as we'll see, this is a pretty direct quotation of Isaiah 16:6, and so he just quotes it directly, we. But I think that it's talking about Jeremiah and his countryman. Jeremiah speaking, and he's saying Moab is very, very proud. Now let's look at the scriptures that say that Moab is proud. Isaiah 16:6, we have heard of Moab's pride, how very proud he is, his haughtiness, his pride, his arrogance, and his empty boasting. That's pretty much a quote, or Jeremiah 48, verse 29 is pretty much a quote of Isaiah 16:6. Ellicott says, because of that, the prophet seems to find a pleasure in going back to the old words as showing that the fault of which he spoke was inveterate and had shown itself incurable. Some other scriptures showing Moab's pride. Isaiah 25, verses 10 through 11. For the Lord's power will rest on this mountain, but Moab will be trampled in his place as straw is trampled in a dung pile. He will spread out his arms in the middle of it as a swimmer spreads out his arms to swim. Swimming in a dung pile. Now that's a great metaphor. Moab's pride will be brought low, along with the trickery of his hands. So Isaiah refers to Moab's pride. And he says, this proud nation is going to be swimming around in a pile of dung. Zephaniah 2, 8 through 10. I have heard the taunting of Moab and the insults of the Ammonites who have taunted my people and threatened their territory. Therefore, as I live, this is the declaration of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel. Moab will be like Sodom and the Ammonites like Gomorrah, a place overgrown with weeds, a salt pit, and a perpetual wasteland. If you drive up through present-day Jordan, that's exactly what it looks like. A place overgrown with weeds, a salt pit, and a perpetual wasteland. The wasteland sort of overcomes you and overwhelms you as you drive through it. It's really quite a remarkable place. But there's nothing there anymore. The remnant of my people will plunder them. The remainder of my nation will dispossess them. Now, I'll talk about how that might have been fulfilled when we get to Zephaniah. There are a lot of prophecies about the nations around Israel getting plundered and then restored, and they're difficult prophecies. But we'll take that up later. This is what they get for their pride, because they have taunted and acted arrogantly against the people of the Lord of hosts. So Zephaniah says the Moabites were proud. No wonder Jeremiah repeats the word pride three times in verse 29. Verse 30, I know her insolence, but it is futile, declares the Lord, and her boast accomplished nothing. Moab was not only insolent against Israel, Moab was insolent against other nations as well. But God says, Moab's boast will accomplish nothing. They're going to get wiped out by the Babylonians. Verse 31, therefore I wail over Moab. Now I'm going to take that I that's wailing as Jeremiah. I can't see God crying too much over Moab, even anthropomorphically. Therefore I wail over Moab, for all Moab I cry out. I moan for the men of Kir-Hareseth. That's the town again, at the southwestern corner of Moab, at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. I weep for you as Jazer weeps. Now Jazer is an interesting town. Let me read you some authorities on what Jazer was. This is from Answers.com. An Amorite town. The Amorites were the famous pagan tribe of the land of Canaan. They were the red-headed ones. They didn't look so Semitic, and they branched out and ended up overruling all the Mesopotamian Valley at certain times in their history. So it was one of the bigger tribes. And they were settling the east of the Jordan River and the east of the Dead Sea until the Moabites came and the Ammonites came and took that area away from them. So Jazer was originally an Amorite town east of the Jordan River, conquered by the Israelites. The Gadites settled there. The tribe of Gad, one of the tribes of Israel, settled at Jazer. They raised cattle there. They built a city. In fact, Jazer was one of the cities of refuge, one of the six cities of refuge, so it was an important town. Isaiah and Jeremiah mention it as a Moabite town. That's because the Moabites took it away from the Israelites at some point. So let's read now from the Encyclopedia of the Bible. The Amorite town was taken by Moses right before the crossing of the River Jordan on the Exodus. Then Jazer was settled and fortified by the tribe of Gad, as I just said. It bordered Ammonite territory. Right to the north, you're going to get into Ammon. Jazer is right to the east of Heshbon, which is at the northern extremity of the Dead Sea, to the east of the Dead Sea. So Jazer bordered Ammonite territory and was one of the four towns of Gad given to the Levites. Some of David's most able men came from Jazer, and his census takers reached it. He took a census of people in Jazer. So David, the Israelites, owned Jazer during the time of David. He's in the 10th century B.C. Following Ahab's death, that's 874 to 853 when he reigned, Moabite conquest changed Jazer to one of their border cities. So the Moabites got Jazer back. During Hellenistic times, it was captured by Judas Maccabeus from the Ammonites. So the Ammonites got it back from the Moabites, and then the Jews in the Hasmonean period got it back from the Ammonites. So in other words, it was right there on the border between Moab and Ammon and Israel. Went back and forth. At the time of this prophecy, it belonged to Moab, and Jeremiah is saying, bye-bye, Jazer, you're going down. You're going to weep as Jazer weeps. I weep for you as Jazer weeps, O vines of Sibmah. Well, what are the vines of Sibmah? Sibmah was a city in the land of Moab, abounding with vines. It was right at Mount Pisgah. That's in the northern portion of Moab, right to the east of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. The vines of Sibmah are right at Mount Pisgah. Sibmah is right at Mount Pisgah. And Pisgah is between Heshbon, which is to the north, and Mount Nebo is to the south. Mount Nebo is where Moses looked out and saw his last view of the Promised Land. And Mount Pisgah is where he died. So that's where Sibmah is. The branches of Sibmah are the inhabitants of Sibmah. And as we see in the rest of verse 32, this reference to branches spreading as far as the sea probably refers to the governors and common people of Moab who were gone over the sea into captivity as they are captured by places such as Cyprus that might have belonged to the Babylonians. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea that the sea mentioned here in verse 32, your branches spread as far as the sea. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, that sea is the Mediterranean Sea. The citizens of Sibmah were transported to Cyprus and other distant lands which were subject to Babylon over the Mediterranean Sea. Now, it could be the Dead Sea. Maybe they're transported to some place that Babylon controlled. I don't know. I think it makes more sense to say the Mediterranean Sea. Your branches spread as far as the sea. They reached as far as the Sea of Jazer. Now, what is the Sea of Jazer? I saw one commentator that said that there was no such thing. There was no sea around Jazer, but Eastern's Bible Dictionary says that the Sea of Jazer was a lake, now represented by some ponds in the high valley in which the Ammonite city of Jazer lies, the ruins of which are called Sar, S-A-R. So I'm going to assume there was some sea, some pond or something around Jazer. Verse 32 is a little bit opaque, a little bit obscure. At the end of verse 32, Jeremiah says, the destroyer has fallen on your ripened fruit and grapes. And of course, the destroyer is Babylon, who came in 582 B.C. More specifically, the king of the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar II. We go now to Jeremiah 48, verses 33 through 36. Joy and gladness are gone from the orchards and fields of Moab. I have stopped the flow of wine from the presses. No one treads them with shouts of joy. Although there are shouts, there are not shouts of joy. The sound of their cry rises from Heshbon to Elealeh and Jahaz, from Zoar as far as Horonaim and Eglath-Shelishiah, for even the waters of Nimrim are dried up. In Moab I will put an end to those who make offerings on the high places and burn incense to their gods, declares the Lord. So my heart laments for Moab like a flute. It laments like a flute for the men of Kir-Hareseth. The wealth they acquired is gone. Now, Jeremiah mentions a lot of place names here, a lot of cities, and he's going from north to south to show that the whole land of Moab is toast. Starting with Heshbon, the very northern border of Moab, right before you get to Ammon, to Elealeh, which is a little bit, couple of miles, maybe 2 miles to the northeast up the road on the way to Damascus. on the way to Ramoth Ammon, present-day Ammon. That's Elealeh. Jahaz is mentioned. That's right at the headwaters of a tributary stream that flows west, maybe southwest, into the Arnon River. It intersects the Arnon River right before the Arnon River dumps into the Dead Sea. So that's Jahaz. It's about 5 miles north of Kiriath, Judas Iscariot's birthplace. Jeremiah mentions Zoar. People are crying in Zoar. Here's what Answers.com says about Zoar. At first named Bela, B-E-L-A, it was the only one of the cities of the plain, see Sodom, to escape destruction. In other words, it's right south of the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah were, but it did not get destroyed along with Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot and his daughters took refuge there. Lot left Sodom when the destruction was coming. Zoar is probably now submerged in the southern end of the Dead Sea. Now, a place called Eglath Shelishiya is mentioned. Now, the older translations, King James, New King James, Young's Literal, Green's Literal, have Eglath Shelishiya not as a town, but rather as a poetic description. They translate it this way, like a heifer 3 years old. So the sound of their cry rises like a heifer 3 years old. John Gill says the taming of these creatures, a heifer, is when they are 3 years old. That is the proper time. Before it is too soon and afterwards too late, and then it is their voice is fuller and their strength firmer, to which the allusion here is. In other words, the heifer's crying out real loud, just like the Moabites are crying out real loud. John Gill says the heifer is a bovine animal. The female voice is stronger than the male, and a heifer is a female. So in other words, the point of the metaphor, if this is a metaphor, is that Moab is crying hard. A heifer, 3 years old, would have been a young cow that had never been yoked, like Moab. Nobody had ever put Moab in Moab's place yet. Well, that's fine, but I think a majority of Bible encyclopedias think that as of 2020, Eglath Shelishiya is a place within 10 kilometers of Zoar, right there at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. However, a lot of Bible encyclopedias think the reference is poetic. I saw this scholar who drew a map showing that as time has gone on with the Bible encyclopedias, the number of people who think it's poetic has dropped, and the number of people who think it's an actual place has increased, and so now there is a slight majority in favor of an actual place. The Bible encyclopedias he consulted were the Anchor Bible, Baker Bible, Erdman's, ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, Tyndale and Zondervan. Well, that's a lot of intellectual work to try to figure out where Eglath Shelishiya is, and I personally don't really give a rip. For even the waters of Nimrim are dried up, says Jeremiah. Well, if you look at the map, you will see the brook Zered running west to east through the mountains and then into the plain right south of the Sea of Galilee, and Zoar is on the brook Zered. Zoar is 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 miles south of the southern tip of the Dead Sea, but right northeast of Zoar, the waters of Nimrim flowing out of the mountains into the Dead Sea, north and east of the brook Zered. But they're going to be dried up. In verse 35 of Jeremiah 48, God says that he's going to make an end to the idolatry of Moab. He's going to end the idolatrous priesthood. He's going to put an end to those who make offerings on the high places and burn incense to their gods. And of course, the main god was Chemosh. Verse 36, my heart laments for Moab like a flute. A flute is what is played at funerals. Again, is this Yahweh or is this Jeremiah? It laments like a flute for the men of Kir-Hareseth, that chief city there in the southwest of Moab. The wealth they acquired is gone. Jeremiah 48, verses 37 through 39. Every head is shaved and every beard cut off. Every hand is slashed and every waist is covered with sackcloth. On all the roofs in Moab and in the public squares there is nothing but mourning. For I have broken Moab like a jar that no one wants, declares the Lord. How shattered she is! How they wail! How Moab turns her back in shame! Moab has become an object of ridicule, an object of horror to all those around her. A great prophetic description of what the Babylonians are going to do to them. Verse 37, there are four symbols of mourning. Head shaved, one, two, beard cut off, three, hand is slashed, cut. And number four, everybody's covered with sackcloth. All of those are traditional forms of mourning. In verse 38, on all the roofs in Moab, apparently they mourned on their flat rooftops and in the public squares, nothing but mourning. Why? Because God has broken Moab like a jar. This refers to a jar that no one wants, which is cheap clay. They broke all the time. That's why all these archaeological sites are full of pottery shards. Cheap clay. Nobody wants the pot. Nobody wants Moab anymore. She's broken. She's shattered. Verse 39, how shattered she is, just like a cheap clay pot. Psalms 60, verse 8 says, Moab is my wash basin. A wash basin would be a cheap clay vessel that people put their dirty feet in. How Moab turns her back in shame in verse 39. She's not able to look her enemies in the face as she gets trampled down. Moab has become an object of ridicule. That reminds us of the verse I just read in verse 26, chapter 48 of Jeremiah. Make him drunk because he has exalted himself against the Lord. Moab will wallow in his own vomit, and he will also become a laughingstock. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, a laughingstock, an object of ridicule. We go now to Jeremiah 48, verses 40 through 44. This is what the Lord says. Look, an eagle is swooping down, spreading its wings over Moab. And of course, that eagle is Babylon. Kiriath will be captured. That's the birthplace of Judas Iscariot. Kiriath is to the east of the highway running through Moab, going from Egypt to Damascus in Syria, the king's highway. It's to the east of it about 8 miles or so. It's almost due east of Dibon, which is a prominent Moabite city. It's right in the middle region of Moab. Not very interesting, except for the fact that Judas Iscariot was born there. So Kiriath goes down, and that day the hearts of Moab's warriors, back in verse 41, Jeremiah 48, the hearts of Moab's warriors will be like the heart of a woman in labor. It seems to me that every reference to women in labor in the Old Testament references pain. Apparently, the Old Testament ladies had not heard of the Lamaze method yet. We do not have to have labor and delivery accompanied with shrieks of pain and anguish. And you might say, well, how do you know you're not a woman? Well, my wife is, and she's deadly afraid of pain, and she went through 3 labors without screaming one time with no anesthetic. So I know what I'm talking about. But the point of the metaphor here is that Moab's soldiers are going to be screaming in anguish because they're going to get wiped out. Verse 42, Moab will be destroyed as a nation because she defied the Lord. Moab had seduced Israel with women and idolatry back during the times of the Exodus. Remember when Phinehas, who exhibited great zeal, the zeal of Phinehas, stabbed the idolatrous woman. I think she was a Midianite woman, an ally of the Moabites. She was shacked up with one of the Israelites, and Phinehas speared him, probably in flagrante delicto, and made him look like a shish kebab. And remember where Balak of Moab, the king of Moab, had requested Balaam to come down from Syria and curse Israel, I think about 4 times. I forgot exactly how many times. Yes, I gave you all the scriptures. Moab had defied the Lord. And so all of this terror is condign punishment for what Moab had done. And Moab is going to be destroyed. Verse 43, terror and pit and snare await you, O people of Moab. Verse 44, whoever flees from the terror will fall into a pit. Whoever climbs out of the pit will be caught in a snare. For I will bring upon Moab the year of her punishment, declares the Lord. In other words, you escape one problem, you end up being faced with another problem, and the end result is your destruction. We go now to verses 45 through 47 of Jeremiah 48, and we will finish this chapter. In the shadow of Heshbon, the fugitives stand helpless. For a fire has gone out from Heshbon, a blaze from the midst of Sion. It burns the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of the noisy boasters. Woe to you, O Moab! The people of Chemosh are destroyed. Your sons are taken into exile and your daughters into captivity. And now verse 47, a very interesting verse. Yet I will restore the fortunes of Moab in days to come, declares the Lord. Here ends the judgment on Moab. doom and gloom and destruction. And yet in verse 47, yet I will restore the fortunes of Moab in days to come. Very interesting. Now in verse 45, we see Yahweh saying, in the shadow of Heshbon. Again, Heshbon is right on the northern border of Moab, right before you get to Ammon. John Gill says, it was a strong city in the land of Moab to which many of the Moabites betook themselves in this time of their calamity. That's why they're called fugitives. In the shadow of Heshbon, the fugitives stand helpless. As Albert Barnes says, as Heshbon was the capital of the Ammonites, the sense is that the defeated Moabites looked to Ammon for protection. Well, at one time it was the capital of the Ammonites. I'm not sure it was the capital of the Ammonites in 582 BC, but it was right there on the border, and there was a fire going out from there. That would be the Babylonians. A blaze from the midst of Sihon. Sihon is the city of Sihon. Sihon was the Amorite who used to own Heshbon, so that's why it's called the midst of Sihon. It's still the same city. A fire is coming out from Heshbon. This is from Joseph Benson. Sihon is a reference to the history of the Exodus. We read in Numbers 21, verses 23 through 24, but Sihon would not let Israel travel through his territory. Instead, he gathered his whole army and went out to confront Israel in the wilderness. When he came to Jahaz, he fought against Israel. I mentioned Jahaz earlier. I should have mentioned this. That was the site of a famous battle. That's where Sihon the Amorite, he'd come all the way down south, down into the southeastern quadrant of Moab, and fought against Israel. Israel struck him with a sword, took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok. Jabbok River runs into the Jordan River, and the Arnon runs into the Dead Sea. So that was a lot of land that Israel won from Sihon. But only up to the Ammonite border. That was at the Jabbok River because it was fortified. So Sihon had gotten wiped out by Moses, by the Jews earlier. And that's why this place, Heshbon, is called a city in the midst of Sihon. And that fire burns the foreheads of Moab. That means the Moabites are getting burnt up. The skulls of the noisy boasters. I like that translation of the NIV. Verse 46, the people of Chemosh. Those are the Moabites. Chemosh was their chief idol. Your sons are taken into exile and your daughters into captivity. That's what the Babylonians do. Now in verse 47, yet I will restore the fortunes of Moab in days to come. Why in the world, at the end of all that doom and gloom on Moab, would God say this? Well, some say that this little phrase was added to comfort the Jews. If Moab is restored a fortiori, certainly also the Jews will be restored. Well, okay, I don't really see that, but it's possible. Well, let's look at two major options as to when this prophecy is fulfilled. When will the fortunes of Moab be restored? Option number one, under Cyrus, 538 BC. Remember, he told the Israelites, since that I, Cyrus the Great of Persia, have conquered the Babylonians who have held you in captivity, you are now free to go back to Jerusalem and Judah. Well, that was the policy of Persia, to resettle people in the conquered provinces so they will make the place prosperous, so they will send taxes to Cyrus. And so it could have been after the Babylonians beat the Moabites in 582 BC that around 538 or after that, near that time, the Persians could have said to the Moabites the same thing that the Persians said to the Israelites, go back to your homeland. As Matthew Poole says, quote, some think this prophecy was fulfilled upon the return of the Jews out of Babylon when the Jews inhabited the land of Moab, referring to Zephaniah 2:9, which says, therefore, as I live, this is the declaration of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Moab will be like Sodom and the Ammonites like Gomorrah, a place overgrown with weeds, a salt pit, and a perpetual wasteland. The remnant of my people will plunder them. The remainder of my nation will dispossess them. Well, that's a great way of being restored. You get restored by the Persians, and then the Jews come in and wipe you out. But Matthew Poole says Zephaniah can't be referring to a physical reduction of the Moabites. He says this, quote, rather to be understood of a spiritual reduction of them by calling some of them under the kingdom of the Messiah, as the Jewish doctors themselves interpret it. Well, we will talk about the Jews possessing Moab when we get to Zephaniah. But we notice that Poole has given an alternative interpretation of this. He says it's not the physical return of the Moabites under the Persians back to Moab. We know that there were Moabites in existence in their country because, as John Gill points out, in the times of King Alexander Junius, he ruled from 103 to 76 BC, Moabites are a nation, as Josephus relates. So I think it's easy to see that the Moabites came back physically to their land and Jeremiah's prophecy is fulfilled. However, there are many commentators who say, no, that didn't really happen. That's not really the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy. That restoration of Moab is a symbol of the bringing in of pagans into the kingdom of Jesus the Messiah. Let me read you from Adam Clark. I have already expressed doubts whether the Moabites were ever restored to their national distinction. The expressions in this chapter relative to their total destruction as a people are so strong and so frequent that they leave little room for a limited interpretation. Clark's right about that. I mean, there's a lot of great rhetoric about how Moab is going to be destroyed. Clark continues, that many of them returned on the Edict of Cyrus, by virtue of which the Jews were restored, that's the famous edict, roughly 538 BC, I doubt not, Clark says. So he does say that many of them returned. But neither the Ammonites, Moabites, Philistines, or even the Jews themselves were ever restored to their national consequence. So in other words, Clark is saying individual Moabites came back fine, but it didn't make a nation out of them. Perhaps the restoration spoken of here, Clark continues, which was to take place in the latter days, may mean the conversion of these people in their existing remnants to the faith of the gospel. Several judicious interpreters are of this opinion. The Moabites were partially restored, but never, as far as I've been able to learn, to their national consequence. In other words, they came back individually, but they weren't a nation. Their conversion to the Christian faith, Clark continues, must be the main end designed by this prophecy. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also has the same idea. Let me quote you from an old commentator named Louth, who is quoted by Joseph Benson. The Moabites were afterward restored to their country, as appears from Josephus. I've just mentioned that. But these and similar promises of mercy after judgment are chiefly to be understood of the conversion of the Gentiles under the gospel, called the latter days and the prophets. The latter days is not the end of the world, it's the end of the Old Testament Jewish order. The conversion of idolaters is expressed by returning from their captivity. Basically, what he's saying is the return is a type of Gentiles coming into the kingdom. We have seen that over and over again when we talked about the return of the Jews from Babylon. Here's what Colin Delitzsch say. At the end of the days, i.e. in the Messianic times, there is in store for them a turn in their fortunes or a restoration. And of course, it could be both. It could be a physical return of the Moabites to the land, which is a type of pagans coming into the kingdom, into the church, in the times of Jesus the Messiah. Now, interestingly, this promise of a restoration of fortune is not only given to Moab, it's also given to Egypt, Ammon, and Elam. Elam is the ancient Near Eastern nation that Persia took over, and it became a province of Persia in the southwestern corner of Persia, right near the Persian Gulf, to the east of the Tigris River. So let's look at these scriptures. Jeremiah 46, verse 26. I will hand them, referring to the Egyptians, over to those who want to take their lives, to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and his officers. But after this, it will be inhabited again as in ancient times. Now that can be fulfilled literally easily because Nebuchadnezzar left Egypt after attacking it. That was sometime in 582, I think it was. I forgot exactly when it was. There's one clay cylinder in the British Museum that says that Babylon went down to Egypt and whacked it after Babylon had burnt Jerusalem in 586. I can't remember the exact date of it, but he went down there. And then Jeremiah says, after that, after Nebuchadnezzar goes down and whips up on the Egyptians, Egypt will be inhabited again as in ancient times. That's because Nebuchadnezzar goes back to Babylon. Egypt continues on its merry way until Cambyses II of Persia came in and took it over in 525. So I hesitate to say that Jeremiah 46, verse 26 is referring to Egyptians coming into the kingdom. Now let's look at Jeremiah 49, verse 6. But after that, I will restore the fortunes of the Ammonites. I don't know how that was fulfilled historically. That might be very well a type of Ammonites, pagans coming into the kingdom. Jeremiah 49, verse 39, in the last days I will restore the fortunes of Elam. Same idea. It's hard to say when in the times of Jesus the Messiah did Elam become another country. I don't think it did. Likewise with the Ammonites. And so then we would need to take Jeremiah's prophecies referring to a future conversion of pagans into the kingdom. That is a subject that would be worthy of more theological investigation if I had the time and I were younger. At the end of verse 47, Jeremiah finishes up by saying, "Here ends the judgment on Moab." Now that could mean the end of the prophecy against Moab. It also could mean a limitation of the time of how long the judgment on Moab would last. In other words, restoring the fortunes is the end of the judgment on Moab. Restoring the fortunes of Moab in days to come, here, there, would end the judgment on Moab. I don't think so. I think it's just referring to this is the end of the chapter. This is the end of the scroll. This is the end of my prophecy against Moab. Ladies and gentlemen, on that sad note, we are now finished Jeremiah 48, and we are prepared to go into our next audio, which will cover Jeremiah 49, which we will call Judgment on Ammon and Edom. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.